Welcome to the Jackalcast.
Well, hello, this is Steven.
And this is Steven.
And this is the Jackalcast.
And today we have another interview for you with a fantastic fantasy author by the name of Steven Brust.
Absolutely. Now, Steven Brust was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and raised in a family of Hungarian labor organizers. Now, exciting as that fact is, there are other reasons that you should listen to this interview.
Yes, it's a family of Hungarian labor organizers, and he became a musician, a computer programmer, and then a fantasy author. I'm not quite sure where that connection comes from, but hey, there you are.
It just naturally leads there. Yes, and he is the author of a number of novels, very few of which I can actually pronounce.
I'm just going to go with Vlad Taltos and let you pronounce everything else.
I believe it. Oh, well, yes, that's only unfair. Anyway, Jereg is how I'm going to say the name of his first Vlad Taltos novel. Jereg is the first of his novels about Vlad Taltos, a human professional assassin in a world dominated by long-lived, magically empowered dragon-like Dragarans. And by all means, send all of your gripes about my pronunciation to nelson@jackalcast.com.
He has written 13 novels in the Vlad Taltos series, which are not necessarily chronologic, but cover a large portion of the life of the character of Vlad Taltos, which I believe is supposed to run 19 novels when it is finally completed. He's also written another series, The Phoenix Guards, which is a three-book series which takes place in the same world as the Vlad Taltos stories, just several thousand years earlier.
What's a couple of thousand years between friends? While writing, Proust has continued to work as a musician, playing drums for the legendary band Cats Laughing, and recording an album of his own work, A Rose for Iconoclastes. He lives in Minnesota, where he pursues an ongoing interest in stochastics. Mostly, I'm sure, because it's hard to say.
What is stochastics?
It's a math thingy.
It's a math thingy.
It's sort of like a computer science-y math thing.
So Stephen is going to be the guest of honor at Convolution in San Francisco Bay Area this November. So we will be talking to him about that, as well as his love of Firefly.
Yes. And this, of course, is our first All Stephen All the Time podcast.
Yes, three Stevens, and since you can't tell how we spell our names from our voices, you'll just have to pay a lot of attention to be in order to figure out who's talking to whom about what. So good luck with that, folks.
Good luck with that. So, without further ado, Steven Brust. Steven Brust, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. So, let me ask you something, Steve.
Please. Either of us, I guess.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if both of you would jump in on
yes.
that.
Yes, this will be a little confusing, because when I say Steven, no one's going to know who I'm talking to.
Yeah, it sounds confusing. Mind if we call you Bruce?
Right.
Because Bruce, well, no, that's even more confusing, because that sounds like Bruce.
Yes.
Shall we start off talking about writing?
Okay, as long as, you know, all the kids are gone.
Okay, yeah, we'll slap an explicit writing tag on this.
Yeah, you know, maybe not safe for work.
Yeah.
Because writing is not a thing to talk about around people who work.
That's true. That's true.
Because they think it isn't work and they're right.
Shh, you're not supposed to tell anyone.
No, that's why
I asked if all the kids were gone.
Right. I was going to say, no wonder all of my friends want to start doing it. Apparently, it's not work. So, you are best known for the Vlad Taltos novels, of which we have, I believe, 13 of them is the current count?
That sounds right, yeah.
You've kind of lost track of yourself?
Yeah, kind of. I haven't moved, and I haven't finished unpacking. When I find the appropriate box, I will have all of my covers put up in little frames on the upper wall of the room so I can look at them when I feel like I can't do this anymore. And then I can count them.
And then you can be reminded, okay, yeah, I did that one and that one and that one and that one.
Right. And it also allows me to count them, you know, when questions like that come up. Otherwise, I don't pay that much attention to it.
So how did you get started writing?
Oh, come on. Same way everyone else did. Just started writing. It's like an itch you get where you want to put words down and tell stories. And after a while, the itch goes away. And then it comes back, and over the course of time, it gets stronger and lasts longer until it's pretty much an obsession. But I think that's true of everyone, isn't it? I mean, isn't that, you know, that's standard writer answer. I think it's like that for all of us weirdos. You write because that's what you do, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. I've often felt that that's what separates the writer from the wannabe writer. The wannabe writer sort of has these grand plans of what they're going to do when they are a writer, and the writer already has 15,000 pages finished.
Right, none of which have sold, but what the hell.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was on a panel once with Neil Gaiman, and that question came up, and he gave the coolest answer, and I remember thinking, God, I did that too. He was talking about being a kid and having writer daydreams, which means, in other words, imagining that you've gone to an alternate world where Lord of the Rings was never written and you're the one who wrote it. And I'm like, God, yeah, I remember that. And the funny thing is, I still have those daydreams with songwriting. Because I've written a few songs, very few. Not terribly good. That's a, if you will, it's something I am followed up on. And so I will still occasionally have value or something like Hallelujah by, come on, work with me, what's his name? Canadian songwriter, Leonard Cohen.
Cohen.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'll just, for a minute, I'll just imagine being the one who wrote that. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Well, so then I guess the next kind of standard question is, once you were a writer, once you had decided that's what you wanted to do, how did you go about that next step of getting published and, you know, actually getting paid for the thing that was your passion?
Well, you have to figure out what your particular problem is that's standing between you and publication,
mm-hmm.
and then find a way to overcome it. Mine was one of the most common there is. It's the tendency to write something, to get two or three chapters into something, and then go back and revise and go back and revise and go back and revise and lose momentum and it never goes anywhere. And that's pretty standard. And at some point I just had to say, okay, I don't care how much it sucks. I'm going to get to the end of this thing. And that was your egg.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and I revised the snide remark I made earlier about when you were talking about editing the podcast and putting it together that way, and I said, that's how I write. Well, that's what I mean. Most of the time, my first drafts are pretty disjointed because I'm figuring out what's going on. And then I'll go back and put them together and make it look like I knew what I was doing the whole time.
Sure. But if you keep on going back and doing that over and over again, you never get to the point where you figure out what you're actually doing?
Right. You get to the end first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now that I'm, you know, cocky enough at this, and you get a certain conviction after a point where you go, yeah, I can do this. I can write. You know, I've written blah, blah, blah books. At that point, you know, sometimes I can go, oh, wait a minute, this just took a horribly wrong turn. I'm going to go back and to this point and take it in a different direction. So I can kind of get away with that now.
So do you write things out longhand? Do you type or do you use a computer?
I use the computer. I write in Emacs, Linux machine.
Wonderful. That's something we have in common.
Ah, you're an Emacs guy. Yay.
Yes. Yay. Death to VI.
That's right. A very good friend of mine, David Dyer Bennett, wrote up a mode for me.
Oh, wow. Is it generally available, or is it just you?
It's just me. I've never met anyone else who wanted it. if you want it, I drop me an email and I'll ask David. I'm sure he'd be willing to send it your way.
I'd love that. That would be great.
But yeah, and all of my chapters or stories have the extension .mss. So nice. It looks for that and goes into that mode and sets things so it's comfortable for me to work.
Sure.
And then when I'm all done, I will put it into OpenOffice or something in order to print it.
Wow. Okay. Yes, I had heard that you were technical, but this was a little bit more technical than I expected.
I'm not technical. I used to be. I mean, I used to be a computer guy years and years ago. Since I got out of the business, which was, I think, around 86, I have tried very hard to know no more than I absolutely need to know to do the work.
Right.
So I've deliberately avoided getting caught up in technical stuff because it just keeps getting deeper and there's always more.
Oh, yeah. It can be very distracting.
And I've already got enough things to distract me.
Like people calling you up for podcast interviews and that sort of thing.
For instance, yeah. the way I work is I have three screens in front of me. One is the Linux box, and that I keep open to the most recent page of most current project.
Right.
And then I have two others. I have, you know, I might have TweetDeck open or some movie or a game, online poker or something, so that I can, you know, have my forebrain doing something while my back brain works on the book. And I just turn my head a little, you know, and so I'm constantly going, you know, yeah, that's the last sentence. Yeah, that's the last sentence. Oh, okay, I know what to go there.
So have you figured out, is this the most brilliant thing I've ever heard? Because it sounds like technically you're playing online poker as part of your job. So couldn't you write off poker losses?
I don't have any of those.
Okay, better and better.
I actually, that shouldn't be considered a brag. I'm not an outstanding poker player. I was fortunate enough to have a couple of very good friends teach me some important points. Adam Stemple and Chris Poker Fox Wallace, who are in fact professional players and teachers. And so the net result is I am a winning player. I couldn't support myself at it even if I wanted to. And to me, that'd be a horrible life. But I do win small and consistent.
Well, that's better than the alternative, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the game. And it's the way online poker works, you can have four, five, six games open at once, and I never do that. I play exactly one. So that during the long, long pauses, and most of it is just throwing hands away, right. That's when I can glance over and see what my book is doing.
Neat.
So it works out to be a pretty productive system for me.
I tried the online poker thing a little while. I think kind of like you, it's not a big thing that I do, but poker is a fun game to play. But I've never, the online thing has just never done it for me. For me, a lot of it is the interaction with people at an actual table. What is your experience with online poker? It seems like it's kind of a different thing.
Well, it is a different thing. I used to prefer playing live up until all the poker rooms went non-smoking.
Ah.
And, you know, now if I want to be twitchy and annoyed, I have other ways to do that. So I'm pretty much now stuck to online. But it still has a lot of the same thing. It's the same pleasure you get from 1,000 other activities, you name it. It's the pleasure you get of doing it right.
Right.
Of feeling yourself, you know, of making the good decision, of going, yes, I did this correctly. And there's a certain pleasure that comes with that. And it's very conducive to writing. If you're playing the part of your brain you've got engaged is the, I don't know what you call it, the logical, rational, mathematical part.
Right.
And what you want for writing is to have that part available and there while your subconscious is also kicking behind you and going, hey, here's this cool idea.
So you're trying to bring your subconscious out, but sort of have it filter a little bit through your left brain?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in my research, and I love the fact that I can, like, you know, read fantasy novels as part of my research. And I think this kind of goes back a little bit to your comments about the way you write. One of the things I find interesting about the Taltos novels is the way that of the 13 novels, they're not chronologic by their publishing. You kind of jump around within the story. At the same time,
preparing for this interview, you read a bunch of reviews of them.
I will admit I was not able to finish them all, but I have read some of your work.
Any of them?
No, I was not able to read all 13 books before the interview.
Okay. That's fine.
But I also have been talking to people who have read them, who are smarter than me. The word plot bomb was used by my friend. And I'm just kind of curious, when you're writing a long story in this world, but you're also jumping around in time, how do you handle the continuity of everything? And how far out do you have kind of the concepts of where this world is? Even if you've kind of skipped over, it's like, oh, I'm going to have to go back and do a book on that deals with this other thing I just thought of because I'm going to plant something in another book that explains how that works.
It's not nearly that organized, okay?
Okay.
I know a lot of Vlad's life. I have pieces of it all the way along the line. On the other hand, I didn't know I was writing a series when I started. In fact, I think it was the third Vlad novel before I knew I was writing a series, or at least admitted it to myself. That would have been da-dum-da-dum Tekla. But even when I thought it was a standalone, I knew a whole lot about where he'd come from and where he was going. And just knowing that sort of thing adds depth. It's like knowing things about the world that you're not telling the reader. It gives it a feel of verisimilitude. It's a feeling that the thing is actually there. So when I'm picking what I want to work on, it isn't that, okay, I set this up, now I've got to have it go off, or I've had this go off, now I have to set it up. It's not that complicated. It's nothing more than, what story do I feel in the mood to tell? It's, what do I want to read right now? You know, because I think most writers, I at least would like to believe that most writers are writing the book they want to read, but they can't because no one's written it yet. So that's pretty much all I'm doing. And the reason for the weird order is just because those were the stories that I had the itch to tell. It is a little strange. I drew in this offhand line at one point in, which one was it? It was Isola, or Isoli, as I call it. I just drew in this offhand line of Vlad gets this powerful weapon, and Marolan says, well, say hello to her for me when she wakes up. I thought that would be like, I thought that was also a really cool bit of business. Well, apparently that was some sort of a bomb. I had no clue of it because of people going, oh, when is she going to wake up, man? And I just keep getting that. And I get that enough that I feel kind of obligated to at least deal with it. Which is, I think, the only time I've ever felt myself succumbing to fan pressure. You know, I think that's just the one occasion where I said, you know, evidently I set this thing up that is important enough that readers are going to feel cheated if I never deal with it.
Right.
But at the time, it was this line I threw out because I thought it'd be a really cool line to throw in right there.
So I take it you don't keep notes of details of his life, or is it all in your head?
Oh, I keep very extensive notes, then I lose them. The high points are in my head.
Right.
You know, I know this is going to happen. I know that's going to happen. I know what the last bit of the story is. When I started, I had even though I wasn't writing the first one, I had a pretty clear idea of what the beginning of the story was. And, that gives me a lot of freedom. And I like that. It means I can just take something that grabs me and follow it, see where it goes. It means I'm keeping myself entertained. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, I would not have believed that I'd still be writing these books, except under duress, or out of desperation for money. But for whatever reason, they're keeping me entertained, and I'm still having fun with them.
Excellent.
So you had talked about fan pressure.
Yeah.
When that happens, and I'm sure it happens somewhat frequently, fans are generally not shy about giving you their opinions, I'm sure. Fans in general are not shy about giving their opinions. Well, while you may not necessarily take it under advisement, is it nice to get that feedback from people, or?
Oh, God, yes. It's a huge ego trip. I mean, if I didn't have an ego desperately in need of feeding, I wouldn't be doing this. I might still be writing, but I wouldn't be publishing. It's another way to say, hey, look at me, look at me. Mm-hmm. And think of the colossal arrogance it takes to say, here, give me some money and I will entertain you. No, trust me, I will entertain you. I mean, my God, that's pompous. But there it is. That's what I do. So having that come back to me with a, hey, you entertained me, that's just delightful.
You appear to hit a number of conventions. I was looking at your blog, and I see you have several scheduled over the next few months. I guess the question is what's that like for you, and actually not just getting the feedback, but getting it in person and interacting with your fans directly?
Well, you understand that I was a fan for years before I was a writer. So I enjoy the conventions as conventions, you know. I generally go to them and expect to have fun. Being there as a pro, and as a pro with a certain degree of notoriety, adds to the fun. I've heard discussions, for instance, on is it a good idea for a writer to go to conventions for his career? And generally speaking, I'd say no. I don't think they do that much. If you enjoy the convention, that's going to show, and that's probably going to, you'll probably get some nice feedback that way and maybe meet some people. But I don't think in terms of sales, it's worth it. It's just I really like them.
In addition to being a pro, you are also a fan.
Oh, yeah.
What was it that drew you to your first convention?
It was a social milieu, if you will. There were people I knew and had known in high school who'd become involved in the local fan group, the Minnesota Science Fiction Society. And they, said, why don't you come to a meeting? And I don't know how true it is today. I suspect it's still largely this way, but I don't really know. But you go in as this kind of weird person who doesn't know how to relate to the rest of the world, and you're kind of Asperger's. And you walk into this room and you're surrounded by your tribe. And you go, oh, wow, I'm not alone. And I think a lot of different people get that from a lot of different sorts of experiences. Everything from motorcycle clubs to maybe, horse racing or whatever. But for me, it was the people with the interest in reading science fiction. Mm-hmm. And it was just not just that we all read it, but the things I did that got me weird looks from the rest of the world were things that other people here did and were approved of.
Right. And sometimes you just wind up being the normal person in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose there is that in the conventions. You've always got, it's like, I'm the weirdo out there, but when I come in here, I'm just a guy.
Right. Yeah. And that's nice.
Any favorite convention stories or memories?
Oh, boy. There are so many. Okay, here's one. Minicon used to be a very big convention, and then it got to the point where we weren't feeling safe anymore. Got to around 6,000 people and started drawing in people who weren't our type, if you will, and were kind of scary. So we cut it back. Still going on, though. But during one of the big years, I was running operations. And that meant, you know, you're in charge of the security and yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty standard experience. Some guy got too drunk and too obnoxious. And so one of the troubleshooters brought him into the operations area, and I talked to him and I listened to him. And I said, okay, listen, I've listened to you and I think you're drunk. I'm taking your badge and I'm going to give you one beer out of our private stock. You're going to go to your room, drink your beer, crash, come back tomorrow morning, and you can have your badge back. And he opened his mouth to say something. I said, no, don't. Just, if you say anything, I'm just taking it and that's it. You're out. Take the beer, go to your room, crash. And, of course, this is not, you know, a huge thing. This happens all the time.
We've worked cons for a while, and I like the idea of offering somebody a beer to just go to their room and crash.
Oh, yeah, that's okay.
If that happens in operations, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Anyway, that's the way I handled it at that moment, that time. Okay. And it went well. The guy went on grumble. Okay. And I gave him a beer. I took his badge. He went off. And I turn around and Susan Allison, the editor in chief of Berkeley Books, has been watching the whole thing and going with this boy. I had no idea Steve could do that. And all of a sudden, I feel like I'm 10 feet tall now.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah, it was great. I'll tell you another story. I'm assuming some of your listeners are writers or are working on writing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Here's one of my favorite stories. This was at a World Fantasy Con in about 1980. Boy, I bet we could figure out when it was. 84, 85? Maybe even earlier than that. Might have been as far back as 82, because I don't know if my first book was out. It might be that I'd sold it, but it hadn't come out yet, or else I just had one book out. But anyway, there was an editor for Ace named Sue Stone, and I saw her literally dancing in the hall. She was holding a manuscript in her hand, waving it around and twirling through the halls at the World Fantasy Convention, saying, we're publishing this. This is a new author. I found him, and we're publishing it. There's a point to that. There's this image of that people have of editors as standing between you and publication.
Right.
And people don't realize that's what they live for.
Mm-hmm.
For an editor to find something unsolicited, something in the slush pile that's good enough to publish, they just burst. I mean, you know, that's everything pays off for them. It's what they, that's what it's all about. That's why they're doing that. This is my author. I found him. And we're publishing him. And she was just, by the way, the book was Ariel by Stephen Boyette.
That's the editor's side of the "Hey, look at me" feeling, I suppose.
Yeah, kind of. Except, of course, you know, the editor has never got that "look at me" thing.
Right.
The editor is always the "look at him," look at this author.
Mm-hmm. That's actually the problem that I always have when voting for the Hugos for best editor, because if they're a really good editor, I'm not going to know.
Well, okay, you were asking about conventions. I have one. It's my baby.
Mm-hmm.
It's a summer solstice every year here in Minneapolis. Very small, very high percentage of pros. It's called the 4th Street Fantasy Convention, and it concerns itself with how to make fantasy better, how to write better, how to read it better, how to improve the field. And it gets a lot into process discussions and here's what isn't happening in fantasy that ought to, and so on and so forth. And okay, I bring this up in this context because many years ago, maybe going all the way back to the first one, which was early 80s, we had a panel on the role of the editor, which had several editors. I think Beth Meacham was on it. I believe Patrick Nielsen Hayden was on it. And some writers, in which I just sort of went off and threw a tantrum about why editors aren't getting any credit on the covers of books, on the inside, you know, flap. Why doesn't it say edited by so-and-so?
Right.
Why aren't you taking responsibility for the crap you're editing and bragging about the good stuff you're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, it's a lot more common now to see that.
Hmm.
And I would like to believe that that is in part because of that panel. We had a lot of high-powered people there. And you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I want to believe that that I had made a contribution to editors, book editors, particularly acquiring editors and line editors, getting some credit. I know that my editors have been outstanding, right? Terry Wendling and Teresa Nielsen Hayden, and their job is to make me look less stupid. I got to approve of somebody who has that for a job.
Well, what makes a good editor?
The ability to put aside, you know, here's what I want, and to go, here's what this writer is trying to do, here's where it fails to do it. And here's some suggestions for how to make it do it. Good editors are incredibly persnickety, pay great attention to detail. When I am reading along, and say I am reading something in the mediocre to bad range,
mm-hmm.
something will happen in the book that will bug me. You know, a clumsy sentence, a sentence that doesn't flow and I have to read it twice, a character doing something that doesn't quite make sense, a minor plot hole, I might skip past it. Part of me will notice it, but I won't consciously notice it. I won't be aware of it.
Right.
A good editor is aware of it. A good editor will hit that and go, wait, what just happened? Why did that happen? And be able to analyze it. I'm a member of a critique group, includes Emma Bull, Will Shetterly, and Adam Stemple, and they all have the ability to do that. To say, you know, here's where it isn't just this didn't work, it's this is why this didn't work, here's where I bumped over it, here's where the problems are. Tremendously valuable.
Is there a way to see a good editor while you're reading? As Stephen had said, and we talk about this, we have an episode regarding the Hugo Awards, because one of the categories is best editor, and it's always, we talked about, it's kind of a tough category for a layman to judge, even if I know that I have read works edited by these people. If the editing is done well, it's hard to see that it was done well.
Well, that's because editing means so many different things depending on context. Are you talking about an editor as in a magazine whose primary job is to go find cool stories? An editor of an anthology who has more or less the same job, although there are some differences? Or are you talking about an acquiring and line editor for a book whose job it is to make the initial decision of I want to push for this book to be published, and now I want to fix it, make it be a better one of what it is. Those are different jobs. The only way I can think of to identify a good acquiring editor, a good, you know, editor in the book sense, is to look for those, well, look for lines, right? Here's a line of book published by Sharon November. Here's one published by Jane Yolen. Here's one published by David Hartwell, and so on. And say, okay, what do I think of that line? How much does my taste agree with this person's? Did that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it is fairly clear that you were a pretty big fan of Firefly. I was noticing your blog has a casting of the Taltos novels, if you could cast them for a TV series using only actors who have appeared in Joss Whedon shows.
Right, right. Firefly is the only science fiction television I have ever liked.
So much so that you wrote your own novel.
I did do that. Guilty as charged.
What makes it superior to, say, Star Trek?
A powerful sense of understatement.
Mm-hmm.
The first time somebody did science fiction and understood that understatement is powerful, that it hits hard, and everything doesn't have to be over the top. That plus just flat out good writing. I mean, I don't know that I can be more precise than to say good writing.
Oh yes, no, I totally agree with you.
Oh, no. No question.
But can you give me an example of where they used understatement on the show?
Let's see. Well, you can see it a lot in my two favorite episodes.
Okay.
Which are? Can we go into this? I mean, can we go into this?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
My two favorite episodes are Out of Gas and War Stories.
Mm-hmm.
Out of Gas is a bunch of really good actors saying to the viewer, look how good our writers and directors are. War Stories are really good writers, really good directors saying, look how good our actors are.
Mm.
But both of those, think of some of the key moments that stay with you in those. The torture scene in War Stories. That could have been done much, much bigger, and it would have been far less effective.
Right.
But you see what they're going through and the way they're dealing with it. Mal needling Wash in order to keep him there, to keep him present. In Out of Gas, it's in the directing all through it. Is there isn't this massive, huge, over-the-top.
Right.
Do you remember the final scene of Out of Gas? The flashback where he sees Serenity, what will become Serenity for the first time, just glances over and there's the ship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay? It isn't a massive ship, huge in the foreground with a sun rising behind it. Okay?
Right.
It's this ship over in the corner looking like an unused spaceship, and the expression on his face tells you what he's seeing.
Right. It's a big universe, and they've chosen to tell a fairly small story, at least in the beginning. In it.
Right, right. And frankly, that's why when they get over occasionally into some of the bigger things, it tends to be some of the weaker episodes.
Mm-hmm.
For example, what was this one where they find the ship, where you start dealing with Reavers?
Right.
They find the ship. You know, that's not one of the best episodes. It's still good.
No, actually,
it's got moments, and you remember moments in it, like the wonderful juxtaposition of Zoe refusing to say a word when interrogated and Wash just going on and on about how sexy Zoe is. And you remember,
have you ever been with a warrior woman?
Yeah, exactly. Lovely, lovely bits like that. But overall, that's not one of the greatest episodes.
No, that episode is actually the reason that I did not watch the show until after it was off the air, because I had friends who said, you have to see the show, you have to see the show, and I watched that episode. And I wasn't impressed with it, and I did not watch the rest of the show for that reason. And then later, after the show had gone off the air, my friend handed me the DVDs and said, "No, really," and I said, "Wow,
yeah, wow, yeah, exactly." And because it's bigger, even the pilot, even the spaceship almost crashing, the fighter almost crashing on top of Mal and Zoe. Is small, is tight, is about their reaction to it. Him laughing hysterically, she looking disgusted, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, there were some wonderful moments there.
So My Own Kind of Freedom was your Firefly novel. Where did that story come from? How did, I mean, was that, you know, was that sitting watching the show and you just had a thought of a story that you wished you could have written for the show if it had still been on the air?
Oh, let's see. I was bugged into doing it by my friend Kit Kindred and my then girlfriend Kaylon Graves, who both wanted me to write it, and I was powerless to resist. I think what the way I chose where to set it and when to set it is, oh, a couple of little niggling things that annoyed me and I felt weren't handled or weren't done and that I wanted to see handled differently. Kaylee's reaction to River killing those three guys in War Stories.
Mm-hmm.
No power in the verse.
And then in Objects in Space, that is supposed to be settled. And it didn't feel like it to me. I didn't quite buy that that took care of it. So I wanted to push that a little more and say, no, let's actually get into this. And little things like that, little things around the edges. And of course, I saw Serenity, but I absolutely refuse to accept that Wash is dead. No, won't.
Oh, no. Sorry. Uh-uh. Absolutely not.
He dies?
Not really.
I have seen it.
So you published that under a Creative Commons copyright.
Right.
Was this the first your first work that you published that way?
Yeah. We were actually doing a project with Creative Commons share alike, but the project kind of sputtered out. Never quite went anywhere, having to do with some romantic breakups in the household among the people doing it. But there was still that one. And, yeah, I don't know how that stuff works. I don't understand it. You ask Cory Doctorow how that stuff works, because I don't get it.
we did, actually.
Okay, good. He's the right one to ask.
What's your feeling in general on that, you know, without getting into the nuances of what Creative Commons is, what's your general feeling on the concept?
I am all for it. I'm absolutely for it. I have written a new book, a collaboration with an Austin writer named Skylar White, who, by the way, is brilliant. And the only reason we didn't release that under Creative Commons is you have to understand the profound depth of my ignorance about all things relating to business. So when my editor said, Cory Doctorow, Kelly Stroth, they've got these things going on and they're doing those and we're, you know, blah, blah. But in your case, I think it'd be a mistake. I nod and I say, okay.
Right.
On the other hand, going with that book, it's called The Incrementalists. And I am just so excited about it. I almost can't stand it. But going with it is a whole background world, if you will, that we want to open up and let other people write stories in and sell them just because we think the whole idea behind it's so incredibly cool. And so if we can figure out a way around that, the challenge is how do you make the world and the characters and everything Creative Commons share alike and yet publish the book in traditional copyright, this is my book vision,
right,
without having those conflict. And I don't know the answer to that yet. Still trying to work it out.
Collaborative works.
Yes.
Do they all work the same way, or do you work with different authors differently? How does more than one write one story?
In my case, they all work the same way. I write the next fun scene. And as soon as it looks like it might not be fun, then I say, hey, it's your turn.
Well, hopefully they're playing the same game.
Yes, exactly. And in all cases, they've kicked my ass. I mean, in the sense of oh, man, I had no idea that was going to happen. That's cool. I would never have thought of that. God, okay, well, I can take that and I can do this with it. And it's very, very much like being told a story by an excellent storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Megan Lindholm, Emma Bull, Skylar White are excellent storytellers. Those are the people I've collaborated with. So I get to be told a story, and then I get to go, and here's how I want to play with that. It's so much fun. This last one, The Incrementalists, is the first book I can remember that I have of my own that I've continually reread for pleasure. Mm. I just occasionally pull out the manuscript and read it, going, oh, this is fun. I like this book. It's a very strange feeling.
So, can you tell us anything about it?
Oh, let's see. Background, a group of people who are functionally immortal, mm-hmm. with some very definite limitations, have been around since human beings first learned to communicate with symbol, so roughly 40,000 years, mm-hmm. have access to immense amounts of information about everyone. Pretty much anything that's been encoded in symbol, they have a good chance of being able to find. And for very practical reasons, which is explained in the book, they are dedicated to trying to make everything a little better. Mm. So you can go back into it's a setting for secret history, for going back and saying any time in the past there was this thing that could have been worse.
Right.
There might have been one of these people behind it, making it not quite so bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they do it by manipulating people, by knowing for a given person what sort of things will trigger that person's, trigger oxytocin,
right?
For instance, or dopamine. Put the person into the state you want and then suggest something to it.
Is this a secret history of this current world, or is this in a different world?
Well, secret history, by definition, is this world.
Right.
What secret history is you take historical events, or human history as it occurred, you don't change anything, and you work in the cracks. Mm-hmm. You work in the, hey, here's this, if you're Tim Powers, you might go, yeah, Bugsy Siegel was killed in his living room. Here's what was really happening. Or if you're Emma Bull, you go, yeah, here was all the events in Tombstone in 1880, 1881, 1882, and here's the shootout, and here's everything we know. But here, you didn't know that Wyatt Earp had made a deal with the devil, did you?
Right.
Or something, and that there were demonic powers and magical things happening. I'm talking about Territory by Emma, which is just breathtakingly brilliant. Anything by Tim Powers is wonderful.
Oh, yes.
And that's pretty much what secret history is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm working on something a little bit like that myself. And the problem is that after a while, you start thinking that you're not kidding. I keep on finding
exactly right. That's exactly right.
Where myself...
Because that's how things work.
Yes.
If the recipe for writing secret history is as follows. You take some piece of history that interests you and you read a bunch about it. Mm-hmm. Then you take something distant from it in geography or in time or whatever, and you research that, and then you find connections between them, and they're going to be there.
Right.
And then you just start finding there's more and more connections, and you start going, whoa, this is weird.
Yes, it can be really uncanny.
Because that's just how it works. Mm-hmm. If you're going to study those things, you will find those connections.
Exactly. Well, that sounds absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to read it.
Anyway, this deals with certain things going wrong with a particular group of a particular one of them. I'm just madly in love with the characters.
Wow. That sounds great.
Anyway. Yeah. I'm talking about this too much. I apologize.
No problem.
Imagine
me sitting here bouncing up and down geeking.
So according to your bio, it said you were interested in Hungarian cooking.
Well, yeah, it tastes good.
So what makes it Hungarian?
Several things. Obviously, often it has paprika.
Mm-hmm.
It almost always has garlic.
Yes. And
one of the things is the way the Hungarians prepare onions, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. And not something I can do on a regular basis. I can't get it reliably.
Ah.
What you're doing is you're starting out with the onion in whatever oil or fat or lard or whatever you're using, butter even. And you start it out at a high heat and very quickly turn it down to medium. And then you put in a little bit of water or chicken broth or something. And you keep adding a little bit more of the broth over the course of 45 minutes or so at medium heat, stirring a little bit until right before the onions turn pulpy. And then you're done.
Yeah, no, that's got to be a fine... I see what you're saying about that. You can only accomplish that sometimes.
Yeah, it's sort of it always strikes me as like, you know, the old joke about, oh, Johnson Street? Yeah, just watch me and get off two stops before I do.
Yeah, you have to basically, right, do this until right before the onion would completely be ruined.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's one of the things. Also, the secret seasoning in Hungarian food is marjoram.
Ah, yes. Good stuff.
And you find that over and over again, and a lot of times you will find caraway seeds.
Mm-hmm.
The Hungarians got a dispensation from the European Union to grow poppies because poppy seed appears so much.
Oh, okay. So, but since poppies are a controlled substance.
Right. But they wouldn't enter the European Union if they weren't allowed to grow their poppies.
Geopolitics and cooking.
Yes.
Sometimes you have to pick your battles.
Yep, yep. I'm not a terribly good cook. I can cook things I like to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I've had food made by really good cooks. I like it.
So you were telling us earlier about some of your songwriting that you're working on.
Oh, I haven't in forever. I mean, I used to live in a band called Cats Laughing and did a fair amount of songwriting then, but I haven't in a long time.
Did you start with the music and then write the words, or did you, go back and forth, or just...
I would almost always, there was some of each, but most of the time I would come up with the lyrics and then hand it to Adam Stemple or Emma Bull and say, do you feel like setting this? It was really fun once. I wrote a set of lyrics, handed it to Adam. I said, do you want to set this? He said, no. and then he said, here's the thing. In order to be a good song, it's got to have at least one of the following. Humor, suspense, originality, or internal rhymes.
Okay.
And this doesn't have any of those. Okay. Gotcha. It's a lot like sometimes what happens when you're writing a book is you'll get a piece that will set it all off.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time you're done, the piece that set it off no longer fits in it. At my best, I can come up with a good line or two. At my worst, I'm just disgustingly pretentious.
Well, that's in these days.
Oh, good.
Are you doing any playing?
I'm sorry?
Are you doing any playing currently?
Of musical instruments, I think he means.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm now, I just got together with my buddy John Shogren, who's a guitarist and singer, and the two of us have put together a duet doing Irish songs, novelty songs, things like that. I'll be playing guitar, banjo, and dumbek.
What's a dumbek?
Not all at the same time.
Okay.
It's a Middle Eastern hourglass-shaped drum. If you ever see scenes in movies with belly dancing going on, that's the drum that's playing in the background.
Yes. Actually, I'm friends with a belly dancing troupe, so I've seen a dumbek. I just didn't know what it was called.
Right. Or they're also called darbuki or dorbaki. Mm-hmm. It depends on what. Egyptian tabla is another name for it. It's, of the various instruments I play, it's the only one I feel like I can make music on.
Hmm.
I put a lot of hours into that one.